The Gospel according to John is a study that we began together a few months ago at Thanksgiving. This is the most popular biography ever written in world history. I think most of you know that at the very center of the Bible are four biographies. Last week I called them newspapers. They're called Gospels, which means good news accounts. They're news accounts of news that's really, really good. These are the four-chambered heart of the Bible. They are life-changing, love-displaying heart, the very heart of the Bible. They unpack who Jesus is. Now, John is the second shortest. Mark is the shortest. But John, over history, has become the most popular. You might even say John 3:16 is probably the most well-known verse in the world. John has been emphasizing from the very beginning of the gospel that Jesus is the creator who not only created the original creation, but he has the power to remake all that's broken in creation, all that needs fixing. It has been a dominant focus on Jesus as God, the creator, who has become human. The Word took flesh. The Word through whom everything was made, he took flesh. And he has appeared, and we saw his glory. And Jesus' glory is that he is God become man, who has the power to remake creation. Let's pick up our reading now in John 4, verse 43. After the 2 days, Jesus departed Samaria for Galilee. For Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his hometown. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done at the feast in Jerusalem. For they too had gone to the feast. Now let me just make a little comment on what we just read. He has just left Samaria, and he's coming into Galilee. In Galilee, the people are going to basically be interested in Jesus only as a miracle worker. I think what John writes, and I'm not the only one who thinks this, I think that what John writes in the verses we just read is full of biting sarcasm. Jesus has just come from Samaria, where many Samaritans, the people who are despised by the Jews, have believed on him as the Savior of the world and the Messiah. And now he's going back into Israelite territory, and he is welcomed as the great miracle worker. And we're about to read, before we finish today's reading, we are going to see how most of the Jews hated him and wanted him done away with. So he came again to Cana in Galilee. This is where he had worked the miracle of the water into wine at the wedding. And Capernaum. At Capernaum, there was an official. This is probably a servant, an administrative official of Herod Antipas. And this official's son was ill. When this man had heard that Jesus had come from Judea, from Jerusalem all the way up to the northern region of Galilee, he went to him and he asked him to come down and to heal his son, for his son was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, and the you is plural, as it's shown in the NIV and the NAS, unless you people see these signs and wonders, you will not believe. Jesus challenges the Galileans' interest in him only as a man who can work miracles. They're not interested in Jesus himself. They're interested in what he can do. And Jesus takes this man's question, come and heal my son. And he turns it on the entire crowd. And he says, do you all just want miracles? Are you all interested in me? Are you ready to confess me as God become man, the person whom God has chosen to reign as king forever on this planet? Are you interested in me, or are you just interested in a piddly little miracle? The official said to him, verse 49, "Sir, come down before my child dies." And Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. And as he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them what the hour was when the son began to get better. And they said to him, "It was yesterday at the seventh hour." Your marginal note has what we would say in our day, 1 p.m. That's the exact time that the fever left him. And the father knew it was the exact hour that Jesus said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. Notice that John is counting signs. He's recounting signs and counting them. After this, chapter 5, verse 1, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. That's where he had been in chapter 3 when he met with Nicodemus. Now, there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. Those would be like massive hallways that have rows of columns going down each side. And archaeology has revealed that this is an accurate description of what was there before Jerusalem was destroyed. This kind of fact shows that John cannot be making up this stuff. This can't be a community writing 100 years after Jesus and making up these stories and saying these are important for your life. No, this gives evidence that this is a historical account, an eyewitness account. Verse 3 says, "In these hallways formed by the columns lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed." One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" What a question. The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water's stirred up, and while I'm going, another steps down before me." That response indicates that this man is both superstitious and he is angry at the world. "Everyone gets there before me." Jesus said to him, "Get up, take up your bed and walk." And at once the man was healed. He took up his bed and walked. Now that day was the Sabbath. You're not allowed to do work on the Sabbath according to the Jewish laws. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It's the Sabbath. It's not lawful for you to carry your bed." Talk about missing the point. But aren't we so petty like that? It's part of human nature. Someone does something we don't like, doesn't matter how good it is, we will tear them down. Now this invalid who's just been healed, verse 11 says, he answered them by shifting the blame. "It was the man who healed me. That man said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" They asked him, "Who's the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" Now, the man who had been healed didn't know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn. He had left very quickly, and there was a massive crowd in that place. But afterward, Jesus found this invalid who had just been healed in the temple, and he said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." And the man went away and told the Jews it was Jesus who had healed them. This invalid of 38 years is described as quite the character, right? He's superstitious. He's mad at the world. He's blame-shifting. He's unthankful. When Jesus leaves, he doesn't go on this hunt. "I've got to find the man who healed me." He's a tattletale. As soon as he finds out it's Jesus, he goes and rats him out. It's interesting that in verse 14, sin no more that nothing worse may happen to you. Several of the translations take that as stop sinning. Jesus is implying there that his injury had actually been caused by sin. It's the exact opposite of what we're going to see in chapter 9, when the man who's blind and gets his sight back, Jesus says about him explicitly, this man never sinned to deserve this. His parents never sinned to cause this injury. In this case, Jesus implies, this man needs to stop sinning or else something worse will happen. That sin had caused his first injury. This man, apparently 38 years before, had done something to cause his injury. I actually wonder if maybe he was like a construction worker and was working under the influence. I don't know. He'd gotten drunk. Maybe Jesus finds him in the temple. I actually wonder if maybe he was a money changer, a banker there in the temple, a cheat. You wonder if he got into a fight with a customer that he ripped off, or maybe he was doing business with a couple thugs. They worked him over good, left him injured. Not quite sure. Those are guesses. But Jesus says, stop sinning so that nothing worse will happen to you. It seems like the man had gone right back to his sinful lifestyle that had left him injured in the first place. What a character. The main point of the passage that we just read has to do with signs. Now, I'm going to have to park here talking about signs before I state the main point. So put your thinking caps on, stick with me, because in order to understand the main point, we've got to think through signs. What are signs? Well, the term sign refers to a miracle. A sign is a miracle that points to a reality. It signifies, sign, signify. It's a miracle that points to a reality that is more important than itself. What were the signs in these situations? Well, Jesus healed two men with a word. The official's son, he says, simply go, for your son will live. And with that word, the son was healed. Jesus, of course, is proving that he is the creator God become human, and he has the power to fix all that's broken in creation. This has been a major theme of John. But these two miracles are signs in that the miracles are not just there for themselves. The miracles signify something greater. You say, what could be greater than healing a man who's on death's door? What could be greater than making a paralyzed man walk? The answer, Jesus. The signs, the miracles, are there to signify a reality greater than themselves. And what these two miracles are pointing to is that everyone who watched the miracle and everyone who reads about the miracle shouldn't say, wow, that miracle was awesome. They should see the miracle and they should say, who is this man? The miracles are signs. They're signifiers of something greater. The healing was not primarily about the invalid, as one scholar puts it. The signs, the miracles, were primarily about Jesus' identity as Christ and God. Jesus is the Christ, that is, he is God's chosen king to rule on this planet. And he is the Son of God. He is God the Son become man, who will rule forever on earth. The signs are pointing to that more significant reality. Now, again, keep your thinking caps on. We're going to keep digging deeper. Remember last week, Resurrection Sunday? After all of these eyewitness testimonies of how our lives have been changed by seeing the risen Christ, John says, John 20:30, Jesus did many, many more signs. But these are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. See, signs are a really big deal in the gospel according to John. In fact, many people call the gospel according to John the book of the signs. Because John is saying, I am recording all of these signs, these miracles that point to who Jesus is, so that you personally will commit your life to Jesus. Now, there at the climax of John, in John 20, John says that Jesus performed many, many more signs, but these are all written to signify to this great reality that Jesus is the Messiah. How many signs does John record? You know how many signs he records? He records 7 in the first 12 chapters. The two that we read today are signs 2 and 3. The first one was the turning of the water into wine at the wedding. And then John raises the official's son to health before he dies at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then John records how Jesus took this 38-year invalid and he made him walk in front of a multitude. Incredible. Those are the second and third signs. John is going to go to record how Jesus fed 5,000 people with a little lunch meal, and then how Jesus walked on water, and then how Jesus gave sight to the blind man, and then how Jesus raised Lazarus after being dead 4 days. And John says, I am recording all of these signs so that you will personally believe Jesus. Now, if you know anything about John's writings, the Gospel according to John and Revelation in particular, you know that John is fixated on the number 7. Incredible fixation. That is because ever since Genesis 1, 7 symbolizes completeness. There are 7 days that make up a full or complete week. The number 7 reflects completeness. And here he gives 7 signs. He says, Jesus did many more, but I'm recording these 7 so that you will have a complete, a full, a sufficient foundation for making the decision that I'm going to commit my life to Jesus. These are the 7, the complete signs, all the signs that you need to make the decision that Jesus is the Christ. But now John's going to do something really interesting. Okay, we're still plowing through John and his focus on the signs. John gives us 7 signs plus 1. The last sign is Jesus' resurrection. And this last sign is hinted at in the early part of the book, but it is the whole focus of the second half. So you get to chapter 12, and Jesus has worked 7 signs and is rejected by his people, the Jews. He came to his own, and his own rejected him. The signs were not enough. These 7 incredible signs were not enough. And from chapter 13 all the way to the end of the gospel, John sneaks in the big one. You've had enough. But now this man's going to rise from the dead. It's incredible. It's John's way of saying, you've got more than enough to make the decision to commit your life to Jesus. But now I'm going to throw in the greatest one just for fun. Not because any more signs are needed. No. You don't have any excuse for not believing. But consider this one. It's a 7 plus 1 recounting. I say it was hinted at earlier in the book because in chapter 2, if you remember, right after turning the water into wine, Jesus is in Jerusalem at the temple. And he throws over all the tables of the bankers. And he says, you're desecrating this place. You've turned a house of prayer into a house of business. And the Jews look at Jesus and they say, "What sign do you show us to prove that you have the authority over this temple?" And Jesus says, "Tear down this temple, and I'll raise it in 3 days." John's hinting at the very beginning of this gospel account that the big sign is coming. After 3 days, he's going to walk out of the tomb alive. Incredible. One more comment about the signs before we move on. That is this. John deliberately challenges us to think about whether signs are a help to faith or a hindrance to faith. In what we read today, you might have even picked up on this. Jesus performs signs in order to signify to people that he's the Messiah. And John says that's why he records all the signs, so that we will believe. And so you say, oh, signs are a help to my faith. But then you read in chapter 4, verse 48, that Jesus is asking the man who's asking for a sign, "Must I do miraculous signs and wonders before you people will believe in me?" He's exposing the fact that many in Israel won't believe no matter how many signs they're given, because their hearts are selfish. Now, I point this out because some of you may have actually struggled with this issue as you've read through the Gospel of John, or some of you may get into videos on YouTube where skeptics are talking about how the Bible is so full of contradictions. And if you read the Gospel according to John, one of the things that you can do is you can list out apparent contradictions. Maybe you want to do it sometime this next month. Read through the Gospel according to John and have in your notebook a page that has two columns. On the first column, say, "Signs are good." And on the second column, say, "Signs are bad." And list out in the first column every reference that indicates that the signs Jesus does are good. They incentivize faith. They encourage people to believe that he's the Messiah. And then make a list down the second column of references that say Jesus actually warns people about needing signs. He warns people about craving miracles. And list it out. And when you read those verses side by side, you'll say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa. I think John's contradicting himself." And if you come to that point, you are right where John the author wants you to be. Cambridge scholar Peter Williams, in his excellent little book, Can We Trust the Gospels?, explains that these apparent contradictions, not actual contradictions, are a method that John uses to make you step back and think about what you are reading. Are signs good? Are they helpful? Or are they bad? Are they hindrances? You say, well, on the one hand, many people were not interested in Jesus at all. They were only interested in miracles. And for them, signs were damning. They added to the condemnation. And for other people, the signs provided the foundation that their faith, their young, immature openness to Jesus needed. The signs provided a foundation to say Jesus is truly the Messiah. And once they got who Jesus was, they really didn't need signs anymore. It was a help to their faith. Now, I just need to say thank you for tracking with me through a pretty long and complicated explanation. I hope these details, for some of you, they might be revolutionary in understanding the Gospel according to John like you've never understood it before. For some of you, it might really help you because you've wrestled with apparent contradictions in John. I hope there has been some real help in laying this foundation. But now we're ready to state the main point of this passage that we just read in the Gospel according to John. I would put it like this. Jesus healed the official's dying son and the 38-year-old invalid to signify to the selfish Jews that they should submit to him as the Creator God become human, the one who will one day reign forever as king over a planet he completely remakes. The point is massive. Jesus healed the official's dying son and the 38-year invalid to signify to these selfish, unbelieving Jews, they only cared about themselves and their lives, that they should submit to Jesus of Nazareth as the Creator God become human, the man who will one day reign forever as king over a planet he completely remakes. That's the point of this passage. Now, we're landing the plane. I'm ready to conclude. I want to conclude with two questions that will help us apply this passage to us. Two concluding questions. The first is this. Do you want Jesus more than anything? Do you want Jesus more than anything? This question is based on the first account of Jesus healing the official's dying son. Another way I might ask this question is this. Are you interested in Jesus or only what he might do for you? See, when the official came and begged for Jesus to heal his dying son, Jesus made it clear that believing in him is more important than the sign, than the healing of the son. Now that is shocking, especially when you're thinking about a son who's dying. Wait, Joe, you're saying it is more important to believe in Jesus than to have your son healed? Yes. The question is, do you want Jesus more than anything? Are you committed to Jesus more than anything? And when you stop to actually think about this, it makes sense. If the only effect of this miracle was to keep the boy from immediately dying and extend his life, the boy would have died a few decades later and, in fact, did die sometime in the future. We don't have a record of the rest of his life, but this boy eventually died. If all that happened was that Jesus gave this boy an extended life, in one sense, you say, all he did was prolong his death. He, along with all of us, are going to die. A little bit more life. That's option one. But if these people experienced not only a miracle, but a miracle that pointed them to Jesus so that they committed their lives to Jesus, they looked at Jesus as Creator God become human, the Messiah, who's going to reign forever over a remade planet. These people would experience complete forgiveness of all their sins, of all their guilt before God, and these people would be raised to live forever in the kingdom under Jesus' rule. They would experience human life unbroken as it was always intended. Believing in Jesus, what the sign signified, was much more important than the sign itself. Now, just think about it. What do you want most in life? Right now, what do you want most in life? Your heart cry right now should be this. In the morning when I rise, in the morning when I rise, in the morning when I rise, give me Jesus. And when I come to die, oh, and when I come to die, when I come to die, give me Jesus. What we want most in life should be Jesus. Some of you say, but I really want healing. Some of you say, I really want to get married. Some of you say, I really need to get out of debt. You really need Jesus. Other things are fine gifts if God gives them to you. You need Jesus. You can live without anything else but Jesus. You hear me? You can live without anything else but Jesus. I've seen it happen way too much. People are so interested in getting married. They leave Jesus. They go move in with their significant other, not caring what Jesus says. Some Christians totally invert the priorities in their life for money, for reputation, for rising the corporate ladder, and they forsake their responsibilities to their church family. They forsake their responsibilities toward their wife and children, their husband and children, all because they're chasing ambitiously after money and after the next position. You don't need money, the next position, marriage, that house. You don't need it. You need Jesus. If you've got Jesus, you've got everything. I'm speaking to some of you in here who think you need something more than Jesus. You're actually living right now for something more than Jesus. And what you need to do is admit that you're a fool. You need more than a miracle. You need more than a sign. You need more than healing. You need more than money. You need more than a spouse. You need to believe that Jesus is the Messiah. That's your greatest need. I urge you, before it's too late, to call out on Jesus, the crucified, risen, and returning King. I urge you to call out to him. You need him more than anything. Second question. This is the final question. Do you respect Jesus more than anyone? And this grows out of the second account we read, this 38-year invalid. He's probably, I would guess, in his 60s or 70s. As I said before, he's a superstitious, angry, thankless tattletale. The man is pictured quite negatively. Can you relate? Well, when it comes to superstitions, that describes many people in Northeast Ohio. They go to psychics to rid their house of ghosts or to reconcile relationships with the deceased. Many people in our area go to churches thinking that God's going to bless your week if you scratch his back on Sunday. They go into a church building and they dip their hands in the holy water, thinking that it'll cleanse them. They go into church and they think, oh, if I just pray in front of this holy relic, this sacred relic, then I'll get what I ask. It's superstition. Superstition dominates religion in our area. Read obituaries. Talks about how so-and-so passed and today she got her wings. Do you know that humans don't turn into angels after they die? You believe in medieval superstition if you believe that we turn into angels and we get our wings. That kind of doctrine is not biblical. Not at all. Our area is just dominated by religious superstitions. We can relate with this man. Similarly, many, many people in our area are angry and thankless. I have noticed that just one of the common themes, if you interact with anyone in our community, and I pray that God keeps me as I get older from this cynicism, just see so many people in our community mad at the world, blaming everybody. Everyone's out to get me. I've gotten the raw end of life's deal. They might be 50 years old. They're healthy. They're breathing. They've had a job for 35 years, and yet their life's not dominated by thankfulness. It's dominated by cynicism. We can relate to this man. Finally, this man, this 38-year invalid, gets healed, and there's no indication that he ever believed Jesus. You just say, how sad. The account ends with him just going to the authorities and ratting Jesus out. I think many people are like him. They want Jesus to fix my biggest problem so I can go on with my own life. God help! You're not interested in God any more than this man was interested in healing. He healed me so I can go on with my own selfish life, go on with my own plans. This man apparently wanted safety, security, comfort, popularity. He cares so much more. He respects so much more the Jewish leaders than Jesus. So I ask, do you respect Jesus more than anyone? Maybe I could word it like this. Are you aware of all that Jesus has done for you and can do for you? Do you realize that in Jesus is every reason to give your life to him? I mean, for this man, he should have considered his newfound ability to walk as the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more if you give your life to that man who gave you the ability to walk. That's how he should have reasoned. And instead, he was a fool. He walked away and just kept on selfishly living his life. You like that? If you are, if you say, boy, I see myself in these pictures as a person who's interested in what Jesus can give me so that I can go on with my life, I urge you to admit the truth to God and turn to Jesus. This account is designed to drive you to see the wrong use of signs and the right use of signs. Don't look at these signs and say, oh, I guess Jesus could help me go about with my selfish life. No. Instead, look at these things and say, Jesus, I need to bow before you. My final word is actually to Christians who are struggling. All right? I just want you to look down at chapter 5, verse 6. Jesus initiates with this embittered, sinful invalid. He initiates a conversation. Do you want to be healed? Christians, I'm talking to you who have turned from your own waywardness and you have decisively committed your lives. I'm talking to Tri-County Bible Church, okay? Isn't it true that we can absolutely know that our sins have been forgiven, and yet we keep on feeling like Jesus is still out to make us pay for our sins? Christians, isn't it possible to believe that Jesus is for you? I know what Romans 8 says, and yet live like all the trials he's putting in my life must indicate that he's out against me. I just look at that question and I say, look at how Jesus encountered. He took the initiative with this wretch of a man. He took the initiative. And he said, do you want to be healed? And I would just encourage you, Christians, let this renew your mind about the heart of Jesus for you. If Jesus wants to heal this man who really doesn't deserve it, what do you think his heart is toward you? Some of you are right in the middle. You're in the thick of trials. And you're basically saying, I don't know, God, how much longer I can hold on. I mean, Jesus, I know that you have the power to get me out of these trials, but you're not. Why? And you're just about ready to throw in the towel. And I would urge you to hear the words of Jesus ringing in your ear. Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be made well? Do you want all of your trials to end? Do you want all the brokenness in your life and in the world around you to be fixed? Then keep trusting the man the signs point to. Don't stop trusting Jesus. You lose Jesus, you lose everything.